Hey, this is Pokey LaFarge, and you're listening to Walk on the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fine episode of Walking the Floor, the podcast that can't be stopped by the coronavirus. That's right, we're still here at Walking the Floor World Headquarters, not touching anybody. We're in total self-isolation. I say we, I mean me. Washing my hands every 5 seconds, you know, just like everybody else. Hunkered down in the bunker. Walking the Floor World Headquarters, still making sure that you've got something to listen to, at least for an hour or so, while you've got all this free time on your hands, sitting around self-quarantined at home or wherever you are or whatever you're doing. I hope it's not getting too crazy out there. You know, if you've been to the market lately, there's lots of empty shelves. You can't get toilet paper. Shit's about to get real stinky. There's scary headlines every day. It just seems like this feeling of general unease has gripped us all. Because it's fucking scary, but let's not get carried away. I don't know about you guys. I'm at home, just kind of kicking it with my family. My kids are getting a little stir crazy, but trying to keep everybody just, like I said, washing their hands and not getting too carried away. If there is an upside to this whole thing, I would say enjoy yourself quarantine by making it quality time with your family and the ones you love. And if you're all by yourself alone, in isolation, now's the time to catch up on all those Sex and the City reruns you've been meaning to, or if that doesn't float your boat, try YouTube online guitar lessons. That's what I do. That's what I do when I'm sitting around. I just find somebody online that's figured out how to play, like, you know, my favorite Rainbow song, and just boom, dive in. Because it looks like we're all gonna have a little time on our hands these next few weeks, so dig in. And while you're woodshedding those online YouTube guitar lessons, maybe now's the time to take stock of your musical supplies. And if you're a little short on plectrums or strings or capos or any recording gear, anything you need, you just get right on over to Zounds.com, where their wonderful staff of professionals, who are all musicians themselves, can help you get what you need for the best possible prices and get that right to your door quickly and efficiently. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to today's interview. Alright, so this is the second time I've interviewed my buddy Pokey LaFarge, who has a great new album coming out April 10th called Rock Bottom Rhapsody. So we skipped all the sort of personal history stuff and just went straight into, like, what's been going on since the last time we talked, and he's had a lot going on, man. The guy's been through some shit. This is not a particularly lighthearted conversation, although it's not a downer. We just get into some stuff, you know, like the journey, the struggle, the things that make him the artist that he is, as well as, like, you know, get into some talk about religion and politics and things that people often stray away from. So I'm just going to warn you about that. And then at the end of it, if you stick around all the way to the end, you are treated with a brand new Pokey LaFarge tune that he does solo acoustic. So make sure you listen through that. I know the man has a lot of touring planned. I wouldn't be surprised if that's been affected by coronavirus stuff just like everybody else. So, I don't know, check his website or something. I'll post the link to his tour dates on my Walk on the Floor website at the end of this. So, I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. This is Pokey LaFarge on Walk on the Floor. So, I really should have gone back and listened to our interview.
Oh, maybe it's better you didn't, man. It's new. So much has happened since then for both of us.
Totally. Well, I figure that was like the This Is Your Life interview. And now this interview, we can just deal with everything since then. It's been a couple of years. I know you've had a lot of life changes
going
and
back
whatnot.
Before 2017.
Right.
Exactly. There's enough to cover between then and and now.
Well, let's start with your new video, that Fuck Me Up video.
Okay.
I love the song. I love the video. I love when people throw like aggressive language, F-bombs, things like that, into like songs where you don't expect it.
Even if it's 15 to 20 times, I should count how many times. I think it's at least 15 I say the F-word.
Was your label like, I don't know if that should be the single, man.
Well, you know, they, I guess, feel similar to you. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say they would encourage aggressive language, though. You know, it's one of those deals where they're like, man, we really like this song. We would like, we both felt that it would be a good first song to release, would be a good choice for the song to be out front. As we're releasing songs into the release date of April 10th. But, you know, we both knew that it was going to have limitations. It's not going to be able to be played on the radio.
Right.
You know, so therefore it's not going to be like an actual single in that
right,
way.
Right, right.
I will say, we did experiment with editing.
Like taking
that
out of there?
Beep me up, right. All that kind of right, stuff. Right. But it being sung so many times, and maybe just the way that it's been sung, it just sounded totally silly.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's funny. When I made a record a couple of years ago called West Coast Town, and in the chorus, there's an F-bomb, right? And I didn't really even think about it when I was making the record, and I didn't think about all the other songs that had all kinds of adult language in it until after the fact when I had to go edit down clean versions of it all. And I was like, fuck, God, I put a lot of swear words into this shit. And then I made an actual effort with my last record to not swear on anything, not because I expected that it was going to be like a radio hit or anything, but just to not have to deal with that, you know what I mean? And it's funny, what really brought that into focus for me, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I was playing a really little acoustic gig in a surf shop up north and with a friend of mine. And it was all, there was like not many people there, and everybody there seemed to be like a young family with very small children.
Right.
I was like singing my songs in this surf shop, and there was like literally like 5-year-olds rolling around on the floor in front of me, and I was like trying to go like, fuck, like trying to take it off the mic. Like, I was like, oh my God, I have way too many fucking swear words in these
songs.
Well,
that's going to be interesting when it comes to me and the entire band saying the F word at the same time, again, 15 times in a song. When it comes to live, because I would definitely say I don't gear my music towards children, you know, but I do.
It's an adult show.
Well, people. But that being said, I have a lot of families that come out to my shows.
Sure.
My music has been very, I guess it's been received by, you know, apparently kids and families alike, old to young. And I wouldn't, again, write music specifically for a certain age group, but I was particularly sensitive after recording it and realizing, you know, man, this is going to have limitations, of course, not business-wise, but being able to play it live when family's there, and also having my record with families not being able to, you know, hearing stories about families dancing around on my record together, and that warms my heart, right?
Sure.
And so now it's that first song where, you know, yeah, it's rubbed some people the wrong way, which is cool. But also, you know, it's just the way that it is, man.
Yeah, you know? I dig it. I dig the imagery in the video, too. It's like a nice mix of like, you know, nostalgic, you know, old-timey carnival type scenes or whatever.
It's basically it's basically hell. It's basically Satan's playground.
Right.
That's basically what it is. And a guy trying, you know, it's a surrealist look at, you know, not trying to go there and also once being there trying to get out. And
I like that though, when you can't exactly put a date on it. It's like one thing looks like it could be like 1920, and then the next thing is like a gun from right now or what. You know what I mean? It's like I like the when that's mixed up like that.
You know, that's kind of, it's funny you say that. That reminds me of like how I do playlists. You know, you think of music playlists and they have like a vibe.
Right.
It's reggae or it's soul. Even when I make a playlist, it's going from some, you know, beautiful female guitar player and singer from Ecuador in the 40s to, you know, rockabilly to roots reggae to
right.
funk, you know, like every song would be completely different, you know, depending on the, but more so the tempo and the,
well, yeah, and that's like reflected in your music, you know, that's like reflected in the music that you make.
Maybe so. Yeah. Everything is, yeah. Well, this record is especially, every song is completely different.
Well, let's kind of like a mixtape. Let's talk about your new record.
Yeah.
What, give me the lowdown. Like, how'd you approach it in the studio? To me, listening to it, it sounds like, the production is great. It's really like a well-crafted, beautiful sounding record. Like where like, thanks, you know, man. There's like, you know, the instrumentation comes in at just the right point with just the right little thing that slots in here. And you know what I mean? Like it sounds like, you know, what am I trying to say? Like, it just sounds really well done.
Well, it was a result of being carefully crafted. From the beginning, when I was, you know, bringing some of these songs to my producer Chris Seyfried, who collaborated with me in writing a lot of the songs together.
What other bands has he worked with? Like, where?
So Chris is, Chris has produced the last two Trombone Shorty records. He did the first Fits in the Tantrums record. He's also worked with Andre Day. And written a lot of songs with people too, right. So it's nice having a cat who can, you know, producer who obviously is a producer,
right,
but
right.
can play instruments and write songs with you too,
right?
You know,
right.
they're really a part of it, and they really sew their style into it. But also they're part of the blood, sweat, and tears. They're part of the whole process, you know. So you learn to trust them.
When you go in to make a record with that guy, like how sort of assembled are your songs going into it?
Yeah. Well, when I write, I come up with tons and tons of ideas. I come up with a lot of ideas, and it's more a matter of chipping away at it.
Right.
Rarely is it something where I'm want for something to say or lacking a hook or whatever. You know, it's pretty well there. But the cool thing about Chris is too. With Chris is that he's good at editing my stuff, but also we wrote, I would argue, probably the three best songs on the record from the ground up together.
Really?
So F Me Up, Lucky Sometimes, which that video is coming out, that's the ballad.
Okay.
Coming out on in mid-March, right before South By, and then Bluebird, which is another video that's coming out right before the release date in April. But anyways, yeah, to answer your question, I mean, the record was, I wanted to look at it as sort of a mixtape, or at least embracing that it might end up being that way no matter what, because of the myriad of styles that I just seem to naturally work within, if that makes sense. And, but thematically, you know, there was a culmination that was coming, that I was building towards with leaving St. Louis after living there for 9 years, moving on from the band that I'd worked with for that long as well, leaving a long relationship at the exact same time. All these things were ending at the exact same time.
Right.
Starting a new one and moving to Los Angeles and kind of seeing that a lot of the things that I'd gone through in my life, I maybe hadn't healed from, and maybe I was creating some of these changes from a non-healthy place, if you will. Some of them very healthy.
Yeah.
But they can get interwoven, and you can get kind of confused, you know, if you don't have like that, if you're not in touch with the core of yourself, really.
Sure.
And so I kind of wrote, the future into the record, and ultimately I hit a pretty, you know, big, had a pretty big fall, if you will. And
wait, when did you make the record?
I wrote a lot of the songs in 18.
Okay.
And then shit hit the fan for me in early January, and like a week or two later, I started recording the record. So I found out that all these songs that I'd written were basically... I created it in my songs.
Right.
It's really messed up. So now I'm gonna be really careful about what I write about. In the same way that I think that you have to be very careful about what you tell yourself, because then you start to believe it.
Yeah.
You start to believe certain things that just aren't true. right. about people and about the world.
You can make them true.
And about yourself.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen that a million times. You know, people that sort of long for a certain lifestyle and then they get it.
Totally, know? Man. Yeah, we have an incredible responsibility, and sometimes the responsibility that we have seems like just too much. But other times it's like, man, this is really cool that I can literally create
right.
whatever I want.
I want to touch on a lot of that stuff here in a second, but just sticking with the record, you said you stopped working with your longtime band. So who were the guys that played on it? Like, did the producer help put that group of people together?
No.
And are you gonna then tour with them, or do you have to go learn all your songs with like a whole new band of people? A struggle I've
mostly
encountered many
all
times
of
myself.
Well, don't worry, I'm gonna have to explain this a lot this year. This is good. This is warming me up. This is, I think, the first interview, podcast interview, that audio interview that I've done for the
record.
Oh,
really? Oh, nice.
Thank
well,
you, sir.
Hey, there you go, man.
You're warming me up,
yeah,
brother.
We're going to set the template.
Totally. Yeah. So let's get this started right.
You can use this for reference, Joe Rogan.
Yeah, right. Sure. Terry Gross. So it's the same band that I recorded the Something in the Water record with in the same studio in Chicago.
Right.
So these cats up there, Scott Wiegand on keys and vocals, Alex Hall on drums and vibraphones and engineered and mixed it and sang on it as well. Scott sang on it. Joel Patterson on guitar, Jimmy Sutton on bass. And that was the band, really. Casey McDonough did some harmony vocals on it with Scott. I mean, these are the guys that sang all the harmony vocals on the Something in Water record. And we just captured an incredible vibe on that record, and I wanted to go back to that.
Yeah.
But in the way that I did the Something in Water record, I went and taught the band those songs. So now that I have a new band, yeah, I've been rehearsing with my new band. Teaching
you got an L.A. band?
Songs.
Yeah,
bunch no, of guys out here. No, two of them are out of New Orleans.
Okay.
And two of them are out of Nashville. So I recorded the record with pretty much the same instrumentation out of every song, with the idea of, like, when you hear the record, that's what you're going to hear live.
Right.
Sort of a concept record in that way,
right?
If nothing else.
Well, how do you approach it, like, as a band leader? You know, there's studio versions of songs and there's live versions of songs, and they're not necessarily the same thing, you know, and they evolve and whatever. But when you have a new record, especially a new record that's got a lot of, like, sonic details in it the way your new record does, like, how much of a taskmaster are you with the guys that you're playing with? Like, no, that sound comes in here, it's got to be this rhythm, or do you sort of let them do their own thing with it? Or, like, how do you approach that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm still trying to figure that out myself. I think
me too.
You know what I mean? Like, what do you guys do? I mean, I am definitely not... I wouldn't say I'm a slave to the record.
Right.
Maybe more so open to interpretation of what the live songs can be. However, you do have to start somewhere. So I say learn the recordings as they are on the record, get those down, and then let's build off that. Like, for instance, the song Bluebird, which is going to be the second song that goes to radio. Going to be completely different live, you know, and I think for the better. The record, records are like painting, you know, it's like you paint it and then that's the paint, it's up in the museum, that's it, it's done,
yeah.
You can't
yeah.
change it. But every night is performance art,
yeah,
and you know, it's not a stage play,
right?
You know, maybe you can have the same lines, but. A stage play where there's a lot of improvisation allowed.
Right.
I would say more so.
How'd the title track come together? That one's interesting. It did, you know, it's very different from everything else on the record. When I heard it, I was like, fuck, man. That's like some composer chops. It's cinematic.
Oh, yeah. The rock bottom part, just from
it's like orchestrated.
Right. Well, I thought you meant the title of the record.
Wait, was that not the title track?
Yeah. Rock Bottom Rhapsody is the title.
Wait,
what's
the first line or first tune on the record?
Yeah, it's the string theme that plays throughout the record.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought that was the title.
It
the
is.
Title. Okay.
It
right,
is.
Right, right. Yeah.
So I came up with the album title.
And then it kind of comes back in.
Yeah, and then there's a kind of like a little tease to it on the outro.
Right.
No, you're right. So the album title came about from just the album itself being kind of like this rhapsody, in the sense that how do I put this? I'll maybe disregard that. I came up with the album title Rock Bottom Rhapsody, and then that sort of served us in coming up with the titles for the string theme that is on the intro, and then the reprise in the outro,
right.
which are just like elaborating on the string themes that are in the song Lucky Sometimes.
Okay.
And that's, you know, obviously the only string arrangements on the record.
Yeah.
And it seemed to just be perfect to go along with Rock Bottom Rhapsody. I think I came up with a title before we did all that. But I don't know. Either way, it works.
Right. I mean, right, even
like when you hear it, you know what I'm saying. The rhapsody, right. Yeah. And then it's
that even it's the title itself is kind of that thing of like the, you know, like the song Fuck Me Up. It's like the sweet with the somber, you know, kind of stuck together.
Yeah, yeah, definitely
a running theme.
Yes. Yeah, that's sort of the theme within this whole record, where again it's kind of like a mixtape and kind of an amalgamation of, I would say, a lot of darker themes in life,
right?
Not necessarily to be embraced. Sort of lamentations. Every song is sort of like a lamentation,
right?
You know, singing to keep from crying, kind of stuff.
Right.
Kind of like Hank Williams tunes, you know?
Yeah.
But
crying in my beer.
Yeah, kind of, but just in a different style.
There's a good quote of yours that was, the man singing these songs isn't exactly the same man who wrote them. This album is about the story of who I used to be. Which, of course, being the first interview and all, you're going to have to get used to answering this question. It begs the question, who did you used to be? Which you sort of touched on a moment ago, but expand.
Well, parts of who I guess... The man who said that quote is probably saying, I'll speak objectively now. The man who said that quote is saying that there's parts of who he thinks he used to be that he no longer is, but more importantly, doesn't ever want to be again.
Right.
There are a lot of ways, a lot of things you could say about that, and it's kind of challenging to put it succinctly, but you know, as I said earlier, you have to be careful what you come into agreement with, right? And I learned a lot of bad habits, coping mechanisms, you know, escaping, you know, a lot of pleasure seeking and escape tricks, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
Some out of I perceive to be just survival, really. And a lot of them I think I learned on my own. Right. You know?
I mean, are we talking like drugs and drinking and that sort of thing?
Drinking, women.
Right.
All you know, the pitfalls mental
of being
issues.
A working musician. Really?
Yeah, you know, I've tried to, I'm also careful to look at us so differently than people who are not artists. I do know, though, that artists are thrown into the fire, you know, more often.
I mean, I feel like people who do this, you know, artists, people who do this for a living, creatives of any kind are almost, usually tend to be almost more of an exposed nerve, you know, there's a heightened sensitivity that seems to lend it. It's not like everybody that fucking picks up a guitar or whatever is a fuck up Bukowski style, you know, whatever. But there does seem to be, it's a weird thing where people want you to be composed, but the thing that drives people to do what we all do isn't necessarily being like a well-adjusted human being. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I'm open to the possibility that anybody could be an artist.
Right.
Just what, it's just the ones who are true artists, the ones who have made the decision to let nothing get in the way of them being an artist, and that they'll walk through the fire and they'll be poor and they'll not have a family and they'll have fractured relationships. Embrace all of that, because the greatest thing that they feel the reason why they're alive is for their work. You know, I guess why I'm careful to look at us so different as artists, you know, like we're another culture or like another breed. We're really not. It's very human. But I think we're embracing that we're very human.
Right.
Actually, is the thing that can be so beautiful and so dark at the same time. Because that's life, right? It's joy and suffering.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of paraphrasing here. I'm not making any declarations, but you know, we're embracing all of that. We're trying not to ignore anything, where I think a lot of people, I think everybody has to ignore certain things in order to just to get through life, you know. But we take it all in, and we embrace taking it all in, because then we can create something beautiful out of it. But I do think that as musicians, we have the easiest job of all artists. Because if we lost everything, we could go out on the street right now and busk and make money, right. You know. Or like, whereas like a filmmaker needs $1 million or something, right, you know, right. An indie.
Well, not now. You need an iPhone and your, you know, there fucking you iMovie or whatever. There, yeah, but go. I know what you mean. I know exactly what
but
you mean.
But at the same time, as musicians, as touring musicians, we have maybe the hardest job.
Right.
Because it's like we're part sailors, we're part soldiers, we're part truck drivers, and we kind of feel sometimes like a bandit or like a criminal.
Right.
You know, you're coming into a town, you're taking their money and their liquor and their women, and then you're going on to the next and doing the same thing. You know right, what I mean? Yeah. And everywhere you go, everybody knows you're not from there.
Right.
You just have that feel, that look to you, you know, the way you're looking around for that coffee shop or where the hell do I find a breakfast burrito right now? You know what I mean? I'm in Sheffield, England, and I'm looking for a breakfast burrito. You know, they look like a weirdo.
Yeah.
Everybody knows. And that traveling, that every single day on a different interstate and in a different hotel room and in a different green room and a different stage, where at the same time, it's all the same.
Right.
After a while. So, you kind of like are living in this, like a soldier that's been out of war for a while, and that's no disrespect to anybody who has done that. I'm just making an analogy here.
Yeah.
But there is a certain shell shock when you get home, you know, and you're resting in one place for 2 weeks, and then you try and establish a life out of that for a week or two with your girl or with your family, your friends, and then you're back at it for another month all over the world again. It's insanity.
And there's an element of like sort of putting off. It sort of time stops when you go on tour, because you're in this perpetual motion of like you don't have time to think. You have to get to the next town, and you know, your days are mapped out to just barely get to load in on time. You know what I mean? Like there is something about that where it's like you go on tour, you go on a long tour for a month or whatever. You come home, it seems like everybody's moved into some new thing, and you're in the same place. You know, you've been in like a time machine. It's weird. It's a time warp.
I totally know what you're saying, and your nerves get kind of rattled sometimes, right? So, and there's no way to escape it.
Right.
So the only way to escape it is to, you know, as some people do, you know, in an unhealthy way, they drink and drugs and women, because you don't have time to exercise. When the hell are you gonna exercise? You know, you want an extra hour of sleep, totaling 5 or 6 hours at night.
Yeah.
Or do you want to go and exercise? Right. I think I'll take the sleep.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And other, you know, folks that are working 9 to 5s, you know what I mean? They have to wait till after work to go get a drink, usually.
Yeah.
You know? or they have to sit in traffic for an hour before they can even get there. And us, we just got nothing but time on our hands. Nothing but booze and food and for free everywhere you go, you know, just waiting. So.
And so was that part of this whole thing? Like, are you, and I say this as somebody who's been sober for, you know, 13 plus years or whatever.
Nice.
Like, are you, did you quit drinking or quit whatever it was that was sort of leading you astray?
Yeah. It, all except for, you know, I still have a drink.
Right.
Every once in a while, you know, I'll go on binges and stuff like that. And
right.
I wouldn't say recklessly at all. But I've been off the road for the most part this entire year.
Is that the first time you've had a big long break like that?
Yeah. And it was by design. And I was really good for me and really, really terrible at the same time. Last year was crazy. But and this year's going to be a very busy year. And
I think healthy and well rested and ready to go.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I am. You know, I've gained a lot of strength. You know, started boxing last year.
No shit.
So I'm still doing that and drinking less and you know,
there's
going out and chasing chicks and anything like that. You know, I'm just staying focused on myself and it's been really, really good.
Yeah, boxing is the greatest stress relief of any. That's like. It's the best exercise ever.
Totally.
You know, there's nothing like hitting something for an hour and watch your troubles just melt away.
Well, but then, you know, getting into it and learning the different body movements and little subtleties of how not to get hit and how to then react to the other person and hit them, it's incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing. It's like a dance move. It's a dance. And
do you ever go to the fights around town? I mean, there's a lot of good fights come through LA. You know, we got some good fight venues like the StubHub. I don't know what it's called now, but down there in the smaller arena next to where the Galaxy play.
That's the best. I'll have to check something out.
Yeah.
But I'm actually leaving Los Angeles on March 1st.
You're moving out of here.
Yeah, and just putting my stuff in storage and just going to be on the road. And then in between tours, I'm going to, you know, fly to a different country or a different state.
Interesting. Okay, I was going to ask you about this because I know that you just moved here, like, what, a year ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. So you've been here for a minute. Because I'm always kind of fascinated by people moving here because I've lived here forever and I'm fucking at the end of my tether with this place. Like, you know what I mean? I'm ready to fucking be anywhere but LA. So I'm always kind of curious to see, like, what people who are just fret, you know, not like you've never been to LA, but living here is different, you know what I mean? It's a different thing. So I'm always curious, like, what draws people here? What you like about it? Like, what made you choose to come to LA in the first place?
Well, I came here for love and for work. You know, I was with a girl and would have moved anywhere to be with her. Thankfully,
she was based here?
LA. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And, I love Los Angeles, man. I really, really love California. I love the whole West Coast. I always have.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of not really feeling like I have a home anywhere, you know? I've been out of Illinois now for over half my life, you know, right after graduating high school. Just being restless and curious as ever, if not more so than ever, I would say, than I was even when I was younger. The more I see, the more I want to see.
Right.
So being not having an apartment here when I'm gone, you know, a month at a time, that saves me $2,000 a month on rent, you know.
Right.
And I can take that, you know, and I don't know, fly to Colombia, fly to Cuba.
Right.
Fly to Japan.
Do you like the idea of sort of being rootless for a while? Like, is there somewhere on the horizon that you're like, eventually I want to wind up there, but right now I'm just going to go explore?
That's always the thing. I mean, these are, you know, what is real and what's the pipe dream? I mean, it's funny, you know, and I have to be careful for what you wish for, but what you wish for it can't come true. I would even say it will come true,
right.
No matter what you wish for, you know, good or bad. It will happen. Not, of course, in your own timing, but it could happen sooner than you would ever think. It could happen overnight. So, you know, I think being careful what you wish for is maybe, to me, I interpret that as, like, that will determine how you act, you know? But, Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't. I mean, when I'm off the road, I just want to travel and be on the road and play shows. And when I'm on the road and I'm playing shows, I just want to move to rural Ireland and have a family. You know. I don't know. Am I fucked? I don't know, man. I think a good woman can change everything. You know.
Sure.
But it can't change everything. You know. But you know,
nobody there's outside no, there's of no you one ever give, really changes anything. It's like you have to be ready to do whatever the thing is, you know.
Yeah. So with that being said, maybe since I am the one putting me into motion and more often than not changing the course of my direction, just want to keep moving and keep seeing stuff. So if I was to have a steady girl, you know, a rider, she better be ready to travel, man. You know, because it's funny. Yeah, I live in Los Angeles. There's 65,000 homeless people in the city, and here I am going willingly homeless.
Right.
It's funny.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I remember, I don't know when it was, whenever I reached out to you last time, I remember seeing on, like, your Instagram feed, you posted something like, hey, I'm going to be handing out, you know, some meals to homeless people down on Skid Row. DM me if you want to come help, or something along those lines. Tell me about that. Like, I'm curious, like, how did you start doing that work, and what is that, you know, how has that sort of shaped your understanding of this city? Because I think for people that don't live here, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of the same everywhere you go nowadays, that we're tent cities popping up in major urban areas. But like Los Angeles, one of the richest cities in the world, it's fucking shocking when you go downtown and you drive through Skid Row how massive that's become. And it's not just there. It's like every freeway overpass, you know, you look under and there's like five tents and people, you know, it's wild, the sort of the dichotomy of like of the severe, it's almost, you could call it like institutionalized homelessness that we have here, sitting right next to all the wealthiest little enclaves, you know.
Yeah, kind of a caste system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you texted me, you know, a couple months ago, you know, asking when I was going to go down there and do that again. And I've been on traveling and on the road so much the last few months, I haven't even been able to go down there myself. But for the first, I'd say 9-10 months of last year, I would go to Skid Row and hand out supplies from, you know, with different members of a church that I was going to, but then started doing it on my own. So that's when I started doing it, was with people from a church I was going to. But then, I started doing it on my own.
What's that look like? You just make a bunch of food and go hand it out, kind of thing?
Talking
to people? Like, what's
the dynamic? I mean, just the common things, man, is just important. I mean, water is the most important thing. Blankets are good too. Toilet paper and toothbrush and toothpaste. And, you know, bring women. If there's women with you, you know, encourage them to hand out, you know, feminine hygiene products to different females. Deodorant, soap, shampoo, socks, underwear, and food, of course, as well. I just felt that, you know, as a person who came to Christ earlier the last year in January, you know, as Jesus said, faith without good works is useless. So, I just felt like I needed to put that love into action, you know. I think, you know, being a Christian was the catalyst in getting me into going out there and helping people like that. But I always did have a certain yearning to do something. And I think of some things I've realized is that life really can be simple. We maybe just make it more complicated.
Right.
Like, helping somebody is actually very simple sometimes, you know.
Sure.
So Unfortunately.
And the simplicity of your basic needs, shelter, food.
Yeah. Yeah, so all that stuff of bringing supplies to people that are living on the street, noting that the simple thing is maybe even the most essential thing when you go there is nothing that you can buy, nothing you can really physically bring with you outside of yourself. You being there, present with somebody, hugging them, holding their hand, talking with them, listening to them, is part of that whole thing. That's something I realized through doing that.
Would you recognize people down there from one time to the next? Like,
unfortunately, yeah, because you know there are people that are still there, and you know when you come back, you know week after week, and you still see them there, you see certain people firmly entrenched. Some people have been living on Skid Row for 10 years, 15 years.
I mean, what is like some of the stories that you hear from these folks?
Well, from my experience, I would just say to any of you out there listening that, you know, people living on the street is a lesson to everyone that you see. You know, we're all going through something. We're all overcoming something, right? We just have different ways of coping with it. And we also have, some people have more people there to help them. Some people have let certain bitterness and pride, simple as that, drive them to the street, you know. Heartbreak, the broken families. I think mental disorders are very prevalent there. But I think if you fell through the cracks and were living on the street, whatever underlying mental issues that you may already have might have a greater chance of coming to the surface at that point.
It's
not actually the mental disease that drives you to the street.
Right.
It's other things.
It becomes intensified by that experience.
It becomes intensified, and then you start drinking more, and then you start drugging more. Now there's drug addicts already that drives them to the street because they'll do anything for the drugs, and same thing for the booze. Don't get me wrong. I'm saying that there's so many different stories. It's not just like, you can't just lump everybody into one category.
Right. It's interesting. A buddy of mine was talking about recently, he was getting his hair cut, and his hairdresser was complaining about the homeless people in the neighborhood where they were. And this was here in LA. And I thought this was really interesting. Like, she had sort of worked out, like, well, this person's, you know, mentally unstable, so they're, you know, it's okay that they're homeless, you know, makes sense that they're home, but this person, they're just lazy and they're just not, you know, blah, blah, blah. They had worked out this whole sort of calculus in her own head, and I thought it was interesting that somebody like that probably doesn't see, I would think that woman is probably a lot closer to being in a situation that would throw her out on the street than she even realizes.
Oh, man.
And yet
that's
has
the whole point.
Zero
yeah.
compassion for who she judges as being sort of like, it's their fault that they wound up there, as though anybody would make that choice to live through that life.
Almost to the point where it seems like, why do so many people in America work so hard, 2-3 jobs, you know?
And are basically one medical emergency away from...
Yeah.
You know, being homeless themselves.
Why do we hustle so hard, in quotes, in America? You know, why? Maybe are we that afraid because we see how this country doesn't take care of its poor, that we have to hustle that hard? Because if we don't do it, then, you know, but it's kind of the unfortunate thing, you know. All the traveling that I do, especially in Europe, you know, I realize that they work to live, you know. In America, it seems like we live to work. You know,
right?
That's just off to me. That's just not the way it should be.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
That's not a kind of society that I want to live in. If, in fact, I have to live in a society, which I have to. But
it always amuses me when, not to stray into politics, but you know, I do stray into politics from time to time on this show, and on my social media and things like that. And it always makes me giggle a little bit when I see people sort of misunderstand what life in Europe is even like, you know, this sort of misunderstanding of, well, if you have these certain programs, it means that everyone's just living off the state and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, I don't know. For somebody that's been there a million times and seen it and lived it and I feel like I have a decent sense of different cultures around the world. You're like, no, man, you've been sold a bill of goods for a really long time. It's really entrenched in our thinking here, X, Y, and Z, but it doesn't add up, you know?
Yeah. You know, the politics is something that is so hard to wrap my head around. There's so many things that we just don't know, and so many things they're lying to us about. To me, what's more important is culture, because the culture is the people, and then the culture is what hopefully can change the politics for the better. If we just, I mean, how do we change the country, this country, by politics alone, you know? So I think there's something in this culture that is just so, it's so beautiful, the entrepreneurial spirit of America, and the freedom, and the, you know, the power of the individual, the individualism. But at the same time, it's like, it's individualist, and it's not collective, and not willing to help somebody when they're down, and so money driven and greedy, and working so hard that they don't spend time with their families. And I do think that's a big one. I think the family aesthetic in the States, from my experience comparatively to that in Europe, it's ass backwards, man. You know? It's more about the job and the money and the house and all these material things than it is about your family. So,
yeah. Welcome to Southern California.
Well, you know, it's fortunately kind of everywhere in the States. And, yeah. But hey, man, it's beautiful here. I mean, it did the whole thing, you know, what Merle said, if you don't love it, leave it. And it's like, well, I love it, but I leave it from
Well, maybe time you're to time. Leaving it for the time being. Yeah. You're always welcome back. You talked about sort of reconnecting with your faith in the last, you know, whatever, a year or so, or a couple of years. And I'm curious to talk to you about that. And curious from the standpoint that, like, I grew up in a totally non-religious household and not a religious environment at all. And I was kind of trip out on, like, why in California, it's not like there aren't religious people here. It's not like there isn't a history of church and everything. You know, it's everybody came here from somewhere else that had that too. So why is it not here in the same way that it's in so much of the rest of the country?
Oh, I actually beg to differ. I think some of the most amazing churches are out here, and I think that there's some amazing things happening out here.
Oh, no, I mean, and I get that. I mean, even in my neighborhood right here on the west side of L.A., all the streets are named after pastors from the church, you know, 150 years ago or whatever, you know what I mean? It's not like there's no history for that here, but I can tell you, growing up in Santa Barbara, California, I mean, I knew, like, a couple people that went to church regularly. It just wasn't a part of the sort of fabric of, you know, it just wasn't in the air. You know what I mean?
I think to a certain extent, I think that maybe is a good thing, because then it opens up to people like me to come at it from completely fresh slate, and somewhat coming at it from a place of choice and surrender, and even, well, my personal story was out of desperation, whereas somebody who's raised religiously and they're not ever allowed to question anything, you know.
Did you grow up like?
But see, it's the thing. I mean, I just want to say this. I grew up Catholic, you know, and that's the thing. Is I actually think religion is bad. I think religion is that I see in my experience is the very same thing that's pushing a lot of people away from faith. It's pushing a lot of people away from Jesus. I think, you know, there's, you know, look at the horrible things that Catholics have done for generations and generations and generations, you know what I mean? Genocides and it's terrible, but there's also great Catholics. I just think that, you know, there's these, when you get into religion, then man starts creating its own system. None of it is in the Bible.
Right.
You know, where does the Bible talk about cardinals and bishops and popes? Where? So I don't understand all that little stuff. And I think that those little things, again, are the things that push people away from it. So I don't consider myself religious. I consider myself spiritual, but I'm not the kind of person who's like burning sage and having crystals on my mantle or anything like that. That's all cool, whatever you want to do. But for me, it's, you know, I'm not religion, I'm spiritual. My spirituality is Jesus.
And I'm curious, and I don't mean this in like a selfish way, but like sort of what, like when you're sort of, when you were going through that evolution, you know, coming out of that sort of dark period, like what were you looking to, or what were you hoping to get? You know what I mean? Like that sounds terrible to frame it in that way, but so I you know, do you understand what I'm saying? Like what were you looking for, you think?
Well, you know, I got to the point where I just didn't want to live anymore.
Right.
And I had essentially made up my own rules, made my own decisions without conscience. You know, I have conscience, but I, you know, largely ignored it if it was coming up against something that I desired, if you will. I felt like I was in control. And I don't really think that any of us are. I think we fool ourselves into thinking that. I'm not going to pretend to know what a higher power wants. I'm not going to pretend to know why things happen. Mm. I do think that there are mysteries that largely just need to try and be embraced. But by embraced, I mean just kind of surrender to and attempt to be at peace with. So for me, it was more of an encounter with God, to where there's something that I understand is completely insane to anybody who is atheist or just completely opposed to Jesus.
I don't really consider myself an atheist. I think more like an agnostic, you know, just sort of that, like, I don't know.
Sure, yeah. Right. Even that, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's just an encounter.
I think modern day atheism is like it's a religion unto itself, you know, and it's I don't like a lot of the voices that.
Yeah, I saw a sign that said Atheists United on the interstate. I was like, wait, isn't that a religion?
Right.
Yeah, but it's a feeling that it's an out of body experience that, mm-hmm. that happens when you're filled with the Holy Spirit. We get in touch with that and I begged for a sign. I begged for release, I surrendered control to God because I didn't want to live anymore, and I'd hurt so many people and messed up so many things, and just needed foundation. I needed peace, and there's a feeling that came over me that I've never felt, and that I have routinely felt when praying in the Holy Spirit ever since. There's power that comes from the words in the Bible, and especially in the New Testament. And now, a lot of people know the clip notes of Christianity, and I think it's important to. If you're so curious and you're so opposed, to maybe read it yourself and not look at what people have done, distorting those words and doing in the name of God, you know, killing and lying and manipulating and blackmailing and raping and molesting. I mean, that's man. That's not God. So I think there's a striving. We strive towards something. We're always striving towards something. People make horrible mistakes, and some people are just downright evil. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's some things that are also put forth out there in doctrine and law, you know, from a quote Christian people that are very hurtful, and I think ultimately against what God gave us was free will. I don't think I have any right to tell you who you love, who you marry. I don't have a right to tell you what you do. You know what I mean? So long as it doesn't hurt me. I think that I feel sort of an outcast within this world, as Jesus said that we would be as Christians. I feel even more of an outcast within the music world, because there's hardly any Christians in the touring music world. And I even feel an outcast within my own people, within Christians, because I'm not a conservative. I don't believe in conservative politics. I don't believe in some of the things that they say people can and cannot do.
Well, it's funny, you know, the great irony there, of course, is that conservative politics fly in they're the polar opposite of what is sort of.
It's another way of manipulating, you know, and distorting the great words that Jesus said. Right, it's really unfortunate.
Right.
So.
Well, thank you for talking to me about that, because it's a funny thing, you know, like there's so much in this world nowadays that is, you know, the people just get so eggy talking about, and religion being a big one. And, you know, I'm always curious about people's, you know, people's beliefs and people's sort of relationship and their evolution and how they got, you know, how they, why they believe what they believe or whatever. But it's like, it's can be kind of awkward to talk about, you know, just like an awkwardness you almost like kind of put on yourself, you know, but it's just, I'm just curious.
Well, a personal relationship with God is more important to me, as I think essential, obviously, but is me going out there and bashing people upside the head with it and forcing it in conversations ultimately a good thing? Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I would say that it was stressed very heavily to be careful with how you talk about that. I mean, spreading the good word is all well and good, and that was definitely encouraged. But forcing people, or as people have done for generations, you know, killing them if they were opposed to you in the name of your God, it's like, man, wow. So I'm aware of the contradictions. I'm aware of the hypocrisy. But I also know that that's man.
Right.
And that man has done some horrible things, you know, and it still doesn't at all dilute the good word to me.
Sure. So what comes next for you now? You're just at the beginning of what I'm sure will be a very busy stretch.
Yeah, man. Some awesome venues, some awesome festivals. I think we're... the first week of the first tour is in Europe. We get to do the awesome Paradiso. I'm sure you haven't done that in a while, you know.
Yeah.
It's probably been a number of years since you played the Paradiso, but in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Just amazing shows coming up, man. I think we're doing Roskilde and Denmark, and I don't know, man, so much stuff. So, yeah, traveling the world, playing some songs, getting nasty, gonna make people dance, got some good sing-along tunes, you know. Gonna see how this new record, you know, feels to play live and how people have received it, and see how they received the new band, you know.
There was one other thing I meant to ask you about, and I forgot, so I'll just get to it here. Acting. I saw that you're going to be in a movie. You're playing the devil in a movie on Netflix.
No, I'm not.
The devil all the time. Or you're not the devil.
I'm playing. There's no actual devil, but there's a lot of people that are definitely acting as if they were. I play a nasty mofo.
I mean, is acting something you've done before? Or is this like, how'd that come about?
Chris, there's a whole thing, you know. See, bass players want to be guitar players want to be drummers, drummers want to be singers, and singers just want to be actors.
Right.
No, but as a performer, I've had people tell me I should. I've thought about it. I've never gone out of my way to do it. I have done some stuff in the past, but it's always somebody, I've been a result of somebody approaching me. This was the case with this film. It's going to be on Netflix the later part of this year, I think. It's called Devil All the Time. It'll be on Netflix, I play some music in it and act with Harry Melling. Who was, do you see Bout of Buster Scruggs?
Yeah.
He's the guy with no arms and no legs doing those speeches.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So he's like, he's my cousin in the film.
Oh, cool.
I didn't even know if I'm supposed to say that. But
it's a scoop. It's a scoop.
I don't know if I'm even supposed to say that.
Was that. Like, is that something that you would, like, are you looking to do more of that? You think you'll do some more of that?
I'd love to, but I mean, again, I'm not going to go show up at auditions every day
and that kind of thing.
But if
it's going to bring you back to LA, bro.
Right. Just might.
Yeah. That's fucking great, man. Good on you. That's so cool. Yeah, do you want to play a song, or you don't have to, but it's there if you want it, with that nice snakeskin strap.
Yeah. Well, Chris and I have been talking all this this stuff about my new record, but I actually tuned my guitar a whole step down, and I got this at 440, so I'm just going to play something completely different. I'm going to play a new song I just wrote.
Oh, nice. Screamer, or do I need to
No, especially not on this one.
Okay, cool.
Thanks for asking, though. This is called Drink of You, with the refrain, "There's always something to drink about." hammer and nails, poison seal of my tomb. Seeing what kind of prisoner am I inside this empty room. All the girls I've loved before, they change your locks and close your door. There's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. When I drink of you, the lonely night feels right with haunting memories. That is only desperate company the drunken moon keeps. All my friends are married with children, and all I have is this time I'm killing. There's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. When I drink of you, when I drink of you, when I think of you, ooh, that's why I drink of you.
That was the last one.
Oh, shit. Oh, yeah. The night owl threw in his towel and fell down from his tree. A murder of crows was waiting below to sing in harmony. It's easy to love you when you're gone, but when you're here, everything feels wrong. But there's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. There's always something to drink about. When I do you want me to do it again since
yeah,
I messed up?
I like cool? it with that. You're a man after my own heart. I'm a lyric forgetting motherfucker.
Oh, man, I'm the worst. I'm the worst, dude.
All right, that was Pokey Lafarge on Walking the Floor singing a brand new tune, Walking the Floor exclusive, man. Enjoy it and get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put some links up. So you can see what my man Pokey is up to and see if he's rescheduled tour dates or whatever. Maybe he hasn't. Maybe they're just going on his plan. I don't know. All right, that's it for this week. Please stay healthy, stay calm, and stay self-quarantined, and we will get through this thing, people. Come on. It's what we do. We'll be back in a couple weeks. Adios, amigos!
If I never come back, is where I was supposed to be. I want something to